Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're looking at something really critical: handling complex medical situations outside the hospital. We're talking about patients with special challenges, chronic conditions, often in their own homes.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because the usual dynamic flips, doesn't it? When EMS arrives, suddenly the patient, or maybe their caregiver, they're the real experts on the ground for that specific condition or device.
That's a huge shift. It
Yeah.
means standard procedures might not just be unhelpful, they might be wrong. You have to change how you talk, how you assess everything.
Exactly. Communication, assessment, treatment, even deciding how or if to transport it all needs potential modification. And, the stakes are incredibly high.
Because families are managing some seriously advanced therapies at home now. Life support, really.
That's right. So when 911 gets called, it often means that home system, that expertise, has hit a wall. EMS becomes the absolute last resort. Failure isn't really an option.
So strategy number one has to be listen to the patient and caregiver.
All right.
They're your primary intel source.
Absolutely. They know the baseline, they know the equipment. Of course, you still have your other resources, online medical control, electronic references, your partner's experience, but start with the people who live it.
And this home check, it's not just oxygen tanks anymore, is it? We're seeing things that used to be strictly ICU equipment now in people's living rooms.
Oh, completely. It's a whole different ball game. Family members are the go-to for devices that, frankly, many responders might not have seen up close before.
Like tracheostomy tubes.
Yeah, TRACs are a big one, used for long-term ventilation, maybe suctioning secrets, protecting the airway. Basic components, outer cannula, inner cannula, those are important. But the key is knowing what to do when it fails. Because when it fails, you have seconds, maybe minutes.
And there's a specific tool for troubleshooting, right?
Yes, the DOPE mnemonic. It's vital. You run through it quickly. D is the tube displaced or disconnected. O, is there an obstruction? P, could it be a pneumothorax? E, is it equipment failure?
So it gives you a rapid checklist under pressure. What about that obturator piece you mentioned earlier?
Ah, right, the obturator. If the whole TRAC tube comes out, the obturator is what you use to guide it back in. It gives the outer cannula rigidity. Without it, reinsertion can be really difficult, maybe impossible. Knowing where it is and how to use it is crucial.
Okay, moving from airways to, well, the heart. Ventricular assist devices, VADs. These are literally keeping people alive. What's the EMS role there? It seems incredibly complex.
It is incredibly complex, and that's the key takeaway. VADs are amazing. They bridge patients with severe heart failure to transplant or recovery. But for EMS, intervention is very
So you're
limited.
not trying to fix the pump itself.
Absolutely not. Your job is supportive care. Check the power source. Are the batteries okay? Is it plugged in correctly? Fix that if you can. But don't touch the pump settings or try to troubleshoot internal mechanics. That's a fast track to disaster. Your main job is rapid, careful transport.
Okay, stabilize power, support the patient, and transport. Got it. What about less obvious tech? Things like CSF shunts.
Right. Cerebrospinal fluid shunts for hydrocephalus. They drain excess fluid from the brain. The danger here is malfunction, which leads to increased intracranial pressure. It's subtle, but dangerous.
So what are the signs responders should be looking for?
Think about pressure building in the head. So, sudden severe headaches, maybe visual disturbances, unexpected seizures, or just a general change in mental status, confusion, lethargy. Those are the red flags that the shunt might be blocked or failing.
We've talked technology, which is complex enough, but often these clinical challenges overlap with really difficult systemic issues, like poverty.
Yeah, that's a crucial layer we can't ignore. The stats are pretty stark. Something like 11.8% of people in the U.S. live below the poverty line, defined by household size, income, age.
And that poverty directly impacts health, right?
Yeah.
It leads to disparities.
Exactly. Health disparity means certain groups just don't have the same access to care. This leads to higher rates of sickness, injury, disability, even death. It's a direct consequence of unequal access.
And homelessness is a really visible example of this.
Tragically, yes. Over 500,000 individuals experiencing homelessness, and a surprising number, over half are older adults, over 50. They face huge barriers to health care, higher risks of infectious diseases, and often untreated chronic conditions.
So when people can't access regular care, where do they end up?
They end up relying on emergency services. EMS and the emergency department become their de facto primary care. This puts enormous strain on the system. EDs get overwhelmed, resources get stretched thin, staff burnout increases, and you see longer waits for everyone. It affects the whole network.
Okay, let's shift to another incredibly difficult area: potential abuse or neglect. Responders are mandatory reporters, but recognizing it can be tough.
It's one of the hardest parts of the job. We're talking about vulnerable populations, children, dependent older adults, adults with impairments. And it happens across all socioeconomic levels, let's be clear.
What are the kinds of things responders need to recognize?
Yeah.
The definitions.
Well, physical abuse or sexual abuse can sometimes be more obvious, though not always. Neglect is often subtler, failing to provide basic needs like food, shelter, medical care, or protection. It can also include emotional abuse, things that cause significant changes in behavior or function. And the sources also mention things like caregiver substance abuse that puts the vulnerable person at risk, like, say, driving drunk with a child.
Recognizing it is one thing, but the guidance is clear. Do not confront a suspected abuser. That must create a real tension if you feel someone is in immediate danger.
It absolutely does. It's a huge ethical challenge. But the protocol exists for good reason. Confrontation can escalate violence, it can compromise evidence, and it can ultimately hinder getting the victim long-term help through the proper channels.
So the priorities are?
Always. Responder safety first. Then provide the best possible clinical care to the patient, document everything objectively, and then fulfill your legal obligation to report your suspicions to the appropriate agency, like Child Protective Services or Adult Protective Services. Let them investigate.
There's also a warning about not jumping to conclusions, right? Mistaking benign things for abuse.
That's critical nuance. You have to be aware of things that look like abuse but aren't. Mongolian spots, those bluish birthmarks on infants, can resemble bruises. Cultural healing practices like coining or cupping leave marks, even skin irritation or infections, can sometimes be mistaken for signs of sexual abuse.
So it requires careful observation and reporting suspicions, not making accusations on scene.
Precisely. Document objectively what you see and hear. Let the trained investigator sort it out.
Okay, let's pivot from those challenging scenarios to the end-of-life spectrum. Patients with terminal illness.
Right. Defined typically as a disease expected to cause death within about 6 months. Here, often the focus shifts dramatically.
From trying to cure the illness.
To palliative care. The goal becomes maximizing the quality of the time left. Managing symptoms, especially pain. Providing comfort. Supporting the patient and the family emotionally and spiritually. Hospice care is a major part of this, focusing on dignity and comfort, not aggressive treatment.
And this is often guided by legal documents.
Yes, very important ones. Advance directives are key documents like living wills or healthcare power of attorney, where the patient outlines their wishes or designates someone to make decisions if they can't. And then specifically for resuscitation, there are DNR orders, do not resuscitate. These are actual physician orders.
Okay, so respecting those wishes is paramount. Let's talk about physical barriers now. Bariatric patients present unique challenges.
They really do. It's a combination of clinical and operational hurdles. Clinically, airways can be much harder to manage. Standard bag mask ventilation might not work well if they're lying flat. Their respiratory reserve is often lower, meaning you have less time for procedures.
And operationally?
Operationally, it can be logistically demanding. Patients might exceed the weight limits of standard equipment or even the crew's ability to lift safely. Getting them out of small spaces or down narrow stairs requires special equipment, extra personnel, and careful planning. Ramped positioning can help clinically for the airway, but you need the space and gear.
What about patients with cognitive or communication challenges? Developmental or intellectual disabilities?
Yeah, this requires a completely different approach to assessment and communication. Think about Down syndrome trisomy 21. You have developmental delays, cognitive impairment, specific physical features, but also increased risks for things like heart defects or seizures. You need patience and adaptation.
And autism spectrum disorders.
Yeah.
ASD. Huh. That's known for variability in communication and sensory processing.
Hugely variable. The absolute key here is caution and involving the caregiver. Be very deliberate and predictable with communication and especially physical contact. Sudden movements or unfamiliar stimuli can be overwhelming. The caregiver is usually your best guide for how to interact effectively and avoid distress.
Makes sense. And simple sensory impairments, vision or hearing loss.
For visual impairment, the golden rule is narrate everything. Explain what you're going to do before you touch them or move them. Avoid surprises. For hearing impairment, you might be able to do some quick troubleshooting with hearing aids.
What kind of troubleshooting?
Well, check the simple stuff first. Is the battery dead? Try a fresh one. Is it turned on, usually set to M for microphone? Is there earwax blocking the mold? Sometimes just those simple checks can make a huge difference in communication. Recognize the types too, behind the ear, in the canal, maybe even cochlear implants, which are more complex.
And if you're dealing with trauma in any of these patients, with communication barriers.
Assessment definitely needs modification. You might need more time, rely more on physical signs or nonverbal cues. Again, the caregiver is invaluable. They can help interpret, provide history, and just be a calming presence. Let them stay if possible, even during the exam. And consent can be tricky. You might need to find a legal surrogate decision maker, or if it's life-threatening, proceed under implied consent. You know, reflecting on all this, the sheer breadth of what responders need to navigate is incredible. We've gone from socioeconomic factors and tough ethical calls on abuse all the way down to the nitty-gritty of troubleshooting a VAD or a track tube in someone's bedroom.
Yeah, the common thread seems to be adaptability. Constant, radical adaptability.
That's it, exactly.
It really forces this paradigm shift we talked about at the start. You have to accept that for these complex, chronic, often technology-dependent conditions at home, the patient and their family are often the primary source of operational knowledge. They're the experts in their own situation.
Which leads to a pretty big question, doesn't it? If these sophisticated life-sustaining therapies are increasingly being managed at home by family members, by non-professionals, how do we as a society, as an emergency system, properly support this, like, invisible healthcare workforce?
Right. And what happens when that home-based expertise under immense pressure inevitably falters or fails? How prepared are we really to back them up?
Something for all of us to think about.